my pleasure to introduce and welcome Krista Olson. Krista teaches writing, rhetoric, and visual culture. I thought I had it. I'm going blank. University of Wisconsin in Madison, Badger, right? And she's here with her family and two adorable littles who the village has learned to love already. So we are so thrilled to have her this week, and today she's going to focus on photography and social justice. So thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming in after, I imagine, long days of doing other things, finding time for this. As Sharon said, I teach rhetoric, and I think most of us, if you haven't been to a Big Ten school and done a composition course or gone into the field, you probably think of rhetoric as problematic talk. Mm-hmm. So rhetoric is spin. But the field of rhetoric has a really long history, and it got a bad reputation because of Plato, so we can blame way back. But the basic idea of the study of rhetoric is that it's one of my favorite definitions of rhetoric is the art, the fine and useful art of making things matter. And so professionally, I am interested in how, especially pictures and what we see, come to matter in our lives and in our world and in the world around us. And that varies from things that are really overt, so pictures that are designed to change your mind, to the design of a space and how, say for example, the setup of a classroom will affect the way people behave together in that classroom. And so I note, for example, that we are in a space where the presumption in this room is that you're listening to me and not that you're talking to each other. But over the course of this session and any of my other sessions you attend, I'm going to be pushing against that a little bit. I want you to spend time talking to each other. I know a lot about visual rhetoric. I know a lot about how pictures shape art. But when you're working like I do in the humanities and in the area of persuasion, a lot of us come to that with our own experiential knowledge. And so I want you to bring that knowledge that you have into this space as well. So I'll be asking you to reflect. I'll be asking you to talk to each other and share ideas, as well as listen a little bit to me and some of the history that I'm going to share with you. By the end of this session, I'd like you to know a little bit about the history of photography and how it's been used with regard to social and political issues, and then also to be thinking a bit about your own encounters with photographs and how those encounters prod you to action, but maybe also stymie that action over the course of time. And so I want to start out by having us do just a little personal reflection. So I want you to think about two powerful photographs from your life, things that have shaped you or that stick with you, that still come to mind for you. I'd love you to choose one that's more personal, one that comes from your own family life or your own personal experience, and then another that's public, one that you can think of that is sort of would be widely shared, that other people might have seen, that circulated in the news media, for example. And just spend a few minutes thinking about those photographs and think a bit about the context. Where did you see it? What was going on when you saw it? And what made that powerful? And then also see if you can think to yourself if you can still describe those photographs for yourself. And then I'll have you share that with the group. I had thought, being always pessimistic about crowds, I had assumed we could share with everybody, but I think given the size of this room, we'll do some group sharing. But just take, I'll give you 2 minutes just to think a little bit about those photographs, the context in which you saw them, and if you can still describe them for yourself. Now, once you've got one, if you would, wait, I muted myself. If you would turn, I'm thinking if you can get into groups that are sort of 6 to 8-ish and talk to one another. If you would share your names with one another, because you're going to have to talk to each other and see each other in other places. So share your names with each other, and then share a little bit about those photographs. And then I'll give you about 5 minutes for that. So share what you've got. And then I'll ask each group to speak what you found.
So are you going that way? I don't want to be in the middle.
So I want to just thank you for sharing those, and I would love if each group could sort of shout out one picture, especially a public picture maybe, that came up in your group that maybe you all recognized, or many of you recognized in the story.
Girl with napalm in Vietnam.
Yes, yeah, so Nick Utz's accidental napalm photograph.
Two out of the four of us had the same photo.
Yeah, yeah.
Three out of six.
Yep.
JFK's assassination.
Yeah. And was it in the car or of his son saluting?
In the car.
Wow.
Selma and the dogs and the fire hoses as people were.
Oh, God.
Birmingham, but yes. Yes. Yeah.
The Syrian boy on the beach.
Yeah, we had that in the video as well. Yeah,
Syrian boy.
The Syrian migrant boy on the beach. Yeah. And I think it's not shocking that images of death and destruction or loss are some of the ones that stick with us. They are jarring. And they're powerful. And if you join me on Friday, we'll talk a little bit about the ethics of those kinds of images and how powerful they are, and yet also why we maybe ought to feel uncomfortable with our encounters with those images. Not that it's wrong to look at them or to be deeply affected by them, but that we are in a certain relationship with those images from a distance that is worth thinking through. So it won't shock any of you to hear that essentially from the moment photography became possible, photography was linked to politics. This is a daguerreotype. Daguerreotypes were the first kind of photography possible. It was invented in 1839. It didn't become a way to capture human images until 2 years later, because in 1939, exposure times were 30 minutes to an hour. So it wasn't possible for any living thing to stay still that long. But a new kind of lens was invented in 1941 that shortened. In 1841, thank you, that shortened exposure times down to a few seconds and made it possible to stay still long enough. So this is actually the very first known photograph of Abraham Lincoln. And there's fun stories about how this one, it was discovered after his, so it first came to light after his assassination. And the ways people talked about this photograph are really interesting reflections of people's feelings about the Civil War just a few years after it had ended. But so, you know, somebody who, in the moment this is taken, Lincoln is starting to imagine a political life, and getting a daguerreotype taken was a sort of a way to have a public image that could circulate. They were also very personal, though. I've done some work on the U.S.-Mexican War, and soldiers on their, as they were marching south to the U.S.-Mexico border, or to the Question War border, often got daguerreotypes taken and would send them home to their families, so their families would have memories of them. So that sort of moment of immediate invention and connection to politics. And then it was only 40 years later that it became possible to reproduce a photograph reliably in newspapers or publication. So this is a shantytown, or a scene in Shantytown, New York. It actually isn't a shantytown. But that was reproduced in the Daily Graphic. And so after 1880, then photographs started to circulate more broadly. And that began to start this idea that you could do photojournalism, which became even more possible in the 1900s to 19-teens when 35 millimeter cameras became a thing. And suddenly you could carry a Leica or another small camera with you and take a picture in the field in a moment. And that really is what's considered the birth of photojournalism. And again, not surprisingly, early use of photojournalism in scenes of war. This is Robert Capa's really famous, rather iconic image of the death of a loyalist militiaman. So this would be in the Spanish Civil War. There's a lot of discussion of whether this is accurate, whether this actually happened, whether he lived or died. But it circulated in its moment as one of many scenes of the atrocities of the Spanish Civil War. Virginia Woolf actually wrote now I can't remember the name of the essay, but she wrote an essay about the power of photography in the late 1930s, where she was, essentially, she was sent an envelope full of photographs from the Spanish Civil War. And then she's writing to people saying, can't you see how terrible this is? Can't you act in response to it? So this history has been ongoing. But just because those cameras were useful for photojournalism and useful for starting to draw attention to atrocities doesn't mean that photography prior to that moment was apolitical, and nor does it mean that photography was always used to advance justice. This daguerreotype has been in the news recently because the family, so this man that was enslaved in the 1850s, and Louis Agassiz, who was a scientist, a Harvard scientist, commissioned photographs of slaves in order to support his arguments about the inferiority of non-white races. Mm-hmm. And this photograph, or this daguerreotype, belongs to Harvard, and it's regularly used, including in lectures like this one, to talk about slavery, to talk about early racial science. And the family of, so Paparenti was the great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather of a woman, the Lanier family, that has recently sued Harvard for the profit that Harvard has made up to today off of this daguerreotype of an enslaved man, so continuing the effects of slavery into the present. But in that moment, photography was really being used to advance white supremacy. Similarly, Edward Curtis in the early 20th century traveled around the country taking photographs of native peoples. And on the one hand, you can look at this image and you can think, well, there's a dignity here. It's a portrait, and there's a dignity here. But you have to know that Curtis was taking these photographs with the assumption that native peoples were dying out, that these cultures were going to disappear, and they should disappear, but we ought to retain a memory of these cultures. And so he traveled around taking photographs and collecting them. Also, Curtis had a very clear idea in his mind of what an Indian was. And so if you look at Curtis's photographs, the same war bonnet appears in multiple photographs from multiple nations, many of whom did not actually use war bonnets in their cultural traditions. It was Curtis's, and he carried it with him, and he would put it on people in order to make them look Indian and make them look more ceremonial. And I've actually chosen this one in part because it doesn't speak to our stereotypes of who Native Americans are. And then, moving in a little more positive direction, in the early 1900s, if you've heard of Lewis Hine, he took a lot of the photographs of child labor that you may be able to pull into your mind, of images of children at looms, especially. He was part of the National Child Labor Committee that did all sorts of visual work against child labor, and began to show this is what it looks like to be putting children in mills and in mines and to be working at young ages. And really beginning to establish an idea that that was wrong, because prior to the early 20th century, there wasn't a shared assumption that it was wrong to have children work. This is actually the beginning, and I should say primarily for white children and white for middle class children, that there was beginning to have the whole idea that there was a thing called childhood, and that childhood mattered. And so Hine is actually involved in that process of teaching us who a child is and what children are, and that they should be treated differently than adults. And these images are part of that process. Let's see if I can get this. So ever since that, the public circulation of photographs and their apparent power to shape public opinion, this idea that these photographs in some ways helped create an idea of childhood and helped change child labor laws, that's also true, by the way, I should also have added, W.E.B. Du Bois, in addition to all of his writing, created a photo gallery that was sort of illustrating this idea of the talented tent. So he had, as a contrast in a way to the images of enslaved Africans that Agassiz had commissioned, pictures of African-American people as professionals, as dignified, and circulated that to try to change visual culture. The early conservation movement, you may have seen those early photographs of Half Dome and Yosemite or of Yellowstone that circulated to help make the argument for the national parks. So pictures have had this power. And there's been this kind of ongoing relationship between photographs and social movements and photographs and this desire to make social change. What I want one thing to walk away with is an awareness that that photographic power is an ambivalent power. So you remember this photograph that I just showed you, of the child that it comes from the National Child Labor Committee. This version of the photograph, however, actually comes from a book by Thomas Dolly called The Child That Toileth Not, and the whole book was an argument against the National Child Labor Committee and Lewis Hine. He had this line that liars may photograph, and he has a piece, I'll read this to you, you can't read it, but it's this is his, in the book, with his caption, "Doffer boys who earn as much as school teachers," reproduced from one of the National Child Labor Committee's publications in which they deplore child labor. Note the bright, intelligent faces, even to their hair being combed, as compared to the picture of three loafers shown on page 79, represented by the same organization as adult operatives. So Dolly actually was using the same photograph to argue that child labor was a form of moral improvement, that kids who didn't labor were actually at more risk of being vagabonds than children who were working. So we want pictures often to have a power, but they can be used in other ways. The group I was part of, we talked about the photograph from World War II of on, I think it's VE Day, of the sailor kissing the nurse, that just a few years ago, that nurse came forward and said, "I didn't want that kiss, I didn't know that man, he grabbed me and kissed me and I was uncomfortable with it." And now that we're in this era when that's actually possible to say, I want to say it about that photograph. It doesn't change the important work that that photograph did in that moment, but it also maybe changes how we think about, can you read a photograph and say, well, this is exactly what this means, and I know what I can get from it. So I want to then take us now to a moment that came up for many of you in your conversation, and think about the civil rights movement, and I think we're just going to give you a set of images. Some of these are images that you mentioned. You were thinking it was Birmingham, but this is Selma. So also a kind of photograph of Selma, King speaking on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the protest, the Black Power protest at the 1960-something Olympics. 1968. The March on Washington, all moments when photographs really gave us a sense of what was happening and a sense of power. Maybe you can remember the picture of Little Rock Nine, and I'm now Elizabeth Eckford, trying to get to school and being shouted at. So those photographs are part of our national conversation. They've shaped for many, even, you know, I was not born in the 60s, I was born a few years later, and so I didn't live through that period, but even so, these photographs speak to me. I don't know if the two of you are on the younger end, I don't know if they recognize any of them. So they still circulate, we still tell stories about these photographs. But I want to take us specifically to May 1963 in Birmingham. And there were lots of photographers who worked with the civil rights movement. The list is enormous, and there were actually lots of photographers there in Birmingham. But the photographs we're going to look at today are all from Charles Moore, who is sort of known as having produced some of the most iconic images from that moment. And I want to give you a little bit of context, and then please don't let you talk again. I'll give you a little bit of context. So King took the movement to Birmingham in 1963 because he knew that they had a problem. And the problem was that they were doing all of this work and having all these protests, but people weren't, the news wasn't getting out. Sort of the white moderates across the country were saying, well, you know, aren't you pushing a little hard? If you're familiar with the letter from Birmingham jail, King went to Birmingham, they were having these protests, he was arrested, and there was a group of clergy, of white clergy, who wrote a letter to King saying, we agree that segregation is a problem, but you are going too fast, and you're going to alienate people. This sounds very familiar, right, from our current moment. You're going to alienate people. And so King wrote back. And King said, the problem is the white moderate like you, who says, can't you slow down? But you need to know how urgent this situation is. We can't slow down. We can't wait. Justice, I can't remember if Justice Blade, Justice Knight is in that law, in that letter, but it's that's the message he's sending. You're giving me a nod, so thank you. It's in that letter.
I don't know if it's in the letter, but the message is clear.
It's that message. One of my colleagues in the field of rhetoric has a really persuasive argument that the photographs that came out of Birmingham were part of King's campaign to persuade white moderates. So King took the movement to Birmingham because Bull Connor was in Birmingham. Bull Connor was the police chief in Birmingham, and he was known to be violent and to be particularly racist and particularly intolerant of the civil rights movement. And he went really seeking to provoke Connor into a response. And they were there for a while, and nothing was happening. And then they decided that they would bring kids to the protest. And they brought kids in, and that's when the photographs that you might remember happened. That they finally pushed Bull Connor enough that he snapped, and he pulled the full might of the police department against them. So, and those images, I'm going to go through them and come back to this one. Those images are, again, really iconic. The police dogs are green clothes, fire hoses. And this one, I think, is one of the first ones where you can really see that it's children, that these are young people, not grown-ups. But I want to go back now to the front. So this part of why this was effective. So King wanted not just this to happen. He didn't want this to happen to anybody. But he wanted the news media to have to cover it. And they did. And so Life magazine, this is not the cover of Life magazine, but it's a prominent essay in Life magazine that featured about a dozen of Moore's photographs from various moments. You can see in the caption here, I cut off the end of it, but even Life is noting that by attacking the protesters, Bull Connor has rewarded them with an outrage that would win support all over the world for Birmingham's African-American population. So there's this recognition that people have to look at this. And if you look at JFK's correspondence in this moment, one of the things that he started saying was, the Soviets are going to see this. This is going to circulate to places where we are trying to slow the advance of communism, and they're going to see this, and that will undermine our argument that we are a force for freedom in the world. And so these photographs carried an extra force because there was a sense of we're going to be implicated. And you start to see the movement toward civil rights laws that then LBJ carried forward in part because of this moment. So it's a very powerful moment. I apologize, I just skipped over one of the opportunities for you to talk. So let me put you back in your groups for a second and revise on the fly with my session. So I want you to talk a little bit about what you have seen of civil rights photographs. So had you seen these photographs? Had you heard that story? What was your own experience of hearing the story? For those of you who actually, some of you in the room probably were in the moment experiencing the civil rights movement. So do you remember the first time the civil rights movement became palpable for you or for the people around you? Did it have to do with photographs? Are there other photographs that we haven't talked about that come to mind as having been powerful? Or for those of us who are a little younger, what did we encounter? what stories, what pictures, and where did those come to life? Where were we told the stories of the civil rights movement that included these photographs? So just kind of check in with one another about your own experiences. But let me bring you several years of the present. You can stay in your groups. I'm going to make you talk to each other again. So, coming to last summer, which I think all of us were alive for, what do you, and we can, do you want to shout out to the whole group, or would you rather stay in your small groups?
I mean, we're fine.
Small groups are good? Okay. So take a minute now with your small group again to talk about what you saw last summer around family separation and the Trump administration's enforcement of the zero tolerance policy and the rules about separating children from parents. What did you see, and what do you remember from that moment? So chat with one another. And I'll have you shout back to you.
First of all, we want to share something.
Do some folks want to share what they talked about?
One of the things we raised here is, I remember a reporter going to one of the facilities and telling us what was inside the facility, but they weren't allowed to bring cameras.
Right.
And I remember wondering, why can't we see what's going on there?
Yes, so the stories of, there were a number of pictures and also news episodes of people kind of illustrating the inability to get access.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. By various means. Yeah, so the lack of being able to see. Good things. What did you talk about in your group?
All.
What pictures did you describe? What kinds of pictures did you talk about?
One member brought up that, do we know if we can believe anymore because of the posing of the photo?
Yes.
So there's so much going on in any kind of turmoil scene like that, and everybody's trying to get their point picture across.
Yeah, so we know that was a thing even in the early 20th century, but in some ways we feel it more acutely now. We're even more aware of the ability to doctor photographs. We're aware of framing. It's those questions that, you know, has that been photoshopped, is very much part of our narrative, and we're also, I think, aware of the distortions that social media cause, and that we know that we see a filtered view if we're participating in social media. Yeah, so there's a sort of, it'd be an ambivalence, and it's more difficult to feel strongly because you're not confident about what you're seeing for some folks. Yeah.
Although I do think that if the image somehow supports your worldview, then you would tend to believe it, and that then adds fuel to the fire, in a sense.
Yeah.
And if it's contrary to your worldview, then you're not sure you can believe that.
Yeah. And that is very well documented in neuroscience. It's not just a matter of bias, it's a matter of human physiology that we tend to confirm. Confirmation bias. My sister's a pediatrician, she does research on the way doctors have a problem with confirmation bias, that if something is too close, they won't see it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just part of who we are that we wait for that.
Well, a couple things. One, I commented on the fact we don't get broadcast TV because where we are, we simply can't get broadcast TV. We're in Bellingham, but we're in a spot where broadcast TV just doesn't come over. And we don't have cable, so we don't see the NBC, ABC, PBS broadcasts of what is being broadcast around the country on these things. But we do get newspapers and magazines. But I was just in Ohio visiting my brother and sister-in-law, and my sister-in-law says they canceled their newspaper because they don't want to see the kinds of things that are appearing in the newspaper because they don't believe any of it. And I said, well, how do you decide what position you're going to take if you don't have any information about what's going on? If you don't have any basic information on which to have a discussion or make a decision, if you get no information at all and you're just operating on your prejudices, what good is that? What help is that? What
and
just perpetuate your prejudices forever.
But I think we feel that especially strongly right now. So I won't be able to pull the numbers into my head, but when television was becoming a common thing, there were very few channels, and they were mostly broadcast nationally. And so you could be pretty sure that a lot of people, that people who had televisions would have seen the same thing. Similarly, I don't remember the numbers, but Life magazine circulated to an extraordinary percentage of the US population. And so you could be pretty sure that almost anybody in the US saw those photographs from Birmingham. But today, people can really choose what to watch and what not to watch, and you can kind of go off into your corners and then see. And so yeah, there's a, even what we see, even if we see the same thing, we see it in really different ways. Mm-hmm. And don't necessarily have a shared story about it.
Well, and they say the media is making it worse because you watch what you want to reinforce.
Yeah.
And in the current political, that's a real problem.
Yeah.
You already know in your heart what you think's the truth, and it doesn't matter. I didn't see either one of them. I think it was Eastwood made two versions of Iwo Jima. I saw some discussion, I can remember, from some years, not long ago, but some years ago. And how different the Japanese view of the battle was to the American view.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to jump into controversy, so that's an interesting way of trying to confront. It's as a former school principal, I could remember getting two versions of who started what. So I may have great wisdom because of all that. No, I'm generally good with that. So you both get it. And, but
well, there's the story of Solomon, right? The split the baby in two. I heard, Dad, you talk about the photographs of the caravan migrating, and that question of, is that an invasion, or is it a call to action for humanitarian response? Can I just for a moment, though, any other specific images? I think I heard...
There was a picture, and I don't know how many people I saw, and we were trying to decide, well, was it? Was it a picture that was put together intentionally, or was it a picture? But it was a picture of a President Trump with his arms crossed, with a very stern look on his face, looking down. And it was on the front of a magazine of this little child, maybe 2 or 3 years old, crying. And okay,
yeah,
so yeah, so you yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It may okay, maybe you know where I'm going with this.
Yes, so Time magazine.
And looking down, and I'm thinking, okay, are they leading us to think this, or is it? Okay, so
yeah.
You know where I'm heading with this.
Yeah, so this is a photograph. So John Moore is a press photographer with Getty. He has on that list of reading suggestions, he has a book out about the US-Mexico border, and he's been doing just a whole slew of photographs. And he was doing ride-alongs with the Border Patrol. And so this image actually comes, it's one of his images, from
I believe that was the child in that picture.
And this is the child. This image went viral, and then Time magazine photoshopped that child out onto a red background.
On a red background.
Trump
with President Trump
standing
and looking
down
with a stern
face.
Sort of
the confrontation between them. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was the picture. So that played into what we were talking about. Is what did they crop it together?
Yes. Yeah. So they took it from this. Moment. And there was a bit of a flurry around it because Moore didn't say that these two children, that the child was separated from her mother, but it very quickly became a photograph people talked about as this child is being separated from her mother in this moment. And that actually is not what was happening in this moment, but Moore sort of, this came out right at the moment that people were becoming aware of family separation, and so it became kind of the poster image for it. Now, John Moore, he's a photojournalist, so he's not, in a lot of his work, not sort of explicitly trying to take a side. His book really does and tries to humanize the border in some really interesting ways. But I also want to go back. These images also circulated, and I think, I don't remember your name, sir, but you mentioned the not being able to see inside. Fairly early on, in news reporting about family separation, the Department of Health and Human Services released what are called handout photos. So they weren't allowing photojournalists into facilities, but Health and Human Services put together a set of photographs that they made available to journalists to illustrate images. And so I think this image is a really powerful and troubling one, in part because they weren't allowing journalists in. But this is what they thought we could see.
So
both, what are we not seeing, but also this was okay. That they said for some, at some level, from the official perspectives, this was going to be okay to share. This was safe enough to share. And so I think thinking about this as, on the one hand, we can read it as a call to action, but it wasn't given out as a call to action. And I think that makes it sort of an uncomfortable picture.
Mm-hmm. But it was also, I think, when it came out that this photograph was not taken at the time that we, you know,
there's another one of those.
I think that the impression was at first we were seeing what was really going on, and then it comes out, no, this was actually happening during another administration.
That's so
correct.
There's another one of these that's more of a close up. It's through the chain link,
right?
And that one, yes, that one circulated widely of being about President Trump's policies, and it was actually taken during the Obama administration.
Right, and so I think people that were trying, that were supporting the, or not opposing the separation in the same way, some people were, use that as an argument. See, the media is distorting facts. They were using that to support their idea that fake news.
Yeah.
And so it really worked against the idea of, you know, using images to maybe create change to embed, to, you know, keep families together. So it was,
yeah. And when it's also a reminder, right, that the argument then became, well, but Obama did it too, so you're a hypocrite to think that it's wrong. But the reminder that, so thinking about context and what we're primed for, so that liberals were not primed to be critiquing Obama's immigration policies. But in fact, Obama's immigration policies were quite problematic also. Mm-hmm. And immigration activists and people who were involved in immigrant rights movements were very angry at President Obama as well. But then that when the argument becomes, well, you thought it was okay with Obama and it's not okay with Trump, then it deflates the argument that no, it wasn't okay then either. Mm-hmm. But we now know about it, that we're primed to see these images and have them move us to action. Because we're sort of already mobilized, if I'm making some presumptions here, I shouldn't. For folks who are liberal or radical, this primes an action. So confirmation bias, on the one hand, is problematic. On the other hand, sometimes it moves us to action. I think when I joined the group back there, we were talking about how with civil rights photographs, it wasn't just the photographs that might have made people act, that those photographs were in the context of having seen on the nightly news those same images, and they were, you know, talking to friends and reading the news, that no photograph ever moves us in a vacuum. It's about the moment and the context. And so the next step I want to take us to, if we're thinking about these photographs, is, so that was a year ago, and I'm curious, how many of you responded to those in some way, to those photographs, in terms of not just an emotional response, but also an active response? What did you do in response to seeing those and hearing stories?
Called my congressman.
Yes, so we called Congressman Paul.
Contributed to LIRS.
Yeah, made contributions to organizations that were working to end femicide.
I was a witness at Homestead, Florida. Mm-hmm. With the children.
Yeah. So being present, people went in order to be present. And if I recall, that was fairly recent that you did that, so. Any responses?
Preached about it.
Yeah, I taught about it, right? Trying to raise awareness. Other responses?
Yes. Became involved in the sanctuary movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and for some of us, we had short-term responses. We made political decisions based on them. For some of us, we had ongoing responses. I think many of us, I suspect that the fact that you're in this room suggests that you want to still think about some of these issues. And so part of what I'm interested in, both as a sort of scholar, but also as a human being, is what sustains us If we see an image and it horrifies us, and we respond in that moment, what then sustains us in continuing to respond, and continuing to have that thing we saw matter? I said at the beginning that the rhetoric is the art, the fine art of making the fine and useful art of making things matter. If it matters like that, in political terms, we aren't doing all that much. But how do we sustain ourselves? And I was thinking about how ongoing this is. I think all of us are aware that the surge in migration in recent months has continued to produce photographs, has continued to produce stories. I don't think we necessarily have seen the level of outrage that the first reports of climate liberation produced, but perhaps we have seen people beginning to become part of the sanctuary movement, or being a witness, or continuing to call our congresspeople, continuing to hold them to account, continuing to give donations, that all those forms of involvement go beyond seeing an image. And they aren't caused just by the image. I love this particular photograph. Then here are a few that I don't, or actually this one I do, this is, some of you may have seen a brief surge of anger in recent weeks as migrants were being held under an overpass in El Paso because the shelters were full. But this continues to be an issue, that the crowding in such shelters, that photographs circulated, this was in the New York Times the day I was preparing this conversation. So continue to see photographs. How do we keep them affecting us? How do we keep them moving us toward just action? And so I wanted us to just begin to wrap up. We're not going to go our full 90 minutes, sorry folks. Begin to wrap up by thinking about what we can ask of photographs in our lives, but then also what our job is beyond seeing. So I wonder if folks want to share, or have a moment to think perhaps first, about what photographs really actually can do and where their limits are, and then what's our job in response. So take a few minutes and think, and then we'll share some of our thoughts. You're welcome to go back to your group if you want, but you can also just think. Wherever your place is right now at 5 o'clock. All right, folks, I'm going to bring you back. So I'm guessing that you all are as hungry as I am for things other than conversation. So what were some things that came to you? What can you expect of photographs, and what might help sustain their effects for good? Or did you get elsewhere in your conversation and want to share that instead?
Okay, I'm being told I need to say something.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Well, I think as we become more aware and a little more savvy about what photographs can be used for and how they can be, their message and intentions can make a difference. You brought up the fact that the Indians and the blacks and the intentions behind them were not all that honorable, it seems to me. And maybe at the time they were being taken, people didn't know that. And as this information comes out, you see it in a different light. And I think, like the chain link fence, when it came out that it wasn't a recent photo, it was taken in a different administration, it made a difference in how you perceive those pictures. And I think that today, when you see a photo that impacts you, that affects you, then maybe you need to know a little bit more of the story behind the photo, who took it, why, what's the message, what's the intention, so that you have a little bit more information and know how to react to it and what kind of perspective to take on it. So I think it behooves us to have more information than just the photo. Yeah. And probably this is true in the past, it should have been that way too, but we're becoming more aware of how things are being manipulated. I think it's hard, though, to get to the facts, to get to the story, to get to the background. And my husband was saying that he, because he's a little bit more wary of photos and not necessarily sure what they mean, he doesn't necessarily let them impact him as much as maybe they could.
So you hold him off.
Yeah.
Well, and I do think, we were talking a little bit about the downsides of social media. In terms of things not being trustworthy. But there's also an advantage to social media, that you can begin to be aware of people and their histories and the stories they've been telling. So John Moore, the photographer, has a book that's just come out. He also is on Instagram and regularly posts photographs on Instagram. And so he's a person that, you know, he's a photojournalist. He has his own perspectives, but he's also beholden to a certain photojournalistic ethic. And so you can, if you begin to develop trust of the stories he tells, then having that history and being able to follow him and see the images he's putting out begins to make a space where maybe you can trust that person. Not completely. I mean, I think we all have to be cautious about jumping onto bandwagons, but there is there's a space to develop a relationship with somebody through social media that can solve as well as cause problems in that sense. And we can go searching for some of the history. And you have to be careful and you have to be savvy, but you can find some of that history.
Probably that strikes me that the fake news stuff and the bias all make it even more important. There is a strong story that goes with the picture that somehow we say, yeah, I believe the story and the picture represents it and this is the purpose and this is maybe how I should react, instead of just saying, well, no, that network, they said that. And so I think there's a lot of growth we have to do in how we gather our data that we took for granted maybe just 2-3 years ago, that's kind of blown up in our political scene.
And when you gesture to, that network says that network says that, I think there's, occasionally my undergraduate students will say, well, they say that and they say that, so they're both biased. Yeah. And that becomes that's the end of it, they're both biased and I can't believe anybody. But I think you're gesturing with that, looking for the larger histories, looking for more stories, is actually a really important response, that we gather the stories that can be told and are being told about photographs. And that's, in some ways, that's an older way of interacting with media. There was a bigger story and a slower story, but now it's figuring out, I can't get the story for everything.
And the need,
so what am I going to focus on?
Media to be economically supportive is grown huge instead of, because when I was a little boy, I think Walter Cronkite, I don't think he ever intentionally lied. I still don't. But I'm sure he's emotional. I can remember him crying when Andy was shot. So it was more real, in a sense. But again, there could have been this showmanship has been going on for decades, too. It's just how much, I guess.
And I think it is important to not think about our moment as, I think we are uniquely fraught, but I don't think we should necessarily think of it as particularly problematic compared to past histories. That we're differently problematic, maybe, but also differently, have a different opportunity. So I don't have to talk anything about Walter Cronkite, but I do know that the major networks in the 1950s and 60s and 70s were telling a very white story. And it was a story that may have been true, but it was a story that took the perspective and the position and the ideals of a very small section of the population and told that story. And so there may be all sorts of downsides to Twitter, but you can follow Black Twitter, and even if you don't always know that you agree with what you're seeing or that you know that every person who's speaking is completely trustworthy, you can begin to get perspective that was never there in available for a white audience in the 50s, but is today something that we could listen to and begin to see the stories and see the images that are coming out from a group that maybe is not the one whose story has always been told. So there's, I think we've always had to be careful about what we're looking at, and we have to learn new skills for new moments. But as much as I want you to be skeptical of the pictures you see and be thinking about how they're often taken in order to shape your ideas, I also wouldn't want you to walk away thinking, well, it's all so problematic that I just shouldn't trust pictures. I think there's a space to allow them. I think, as you had said, that we can expect that pictures will draw our attention to things. And that that force of bringing something to light for us is a really important role that they play. And then we have a lot that we can bring to those, a lot of opportunities, resources and ideas that we can bring to photographs. So I'm going to wrap us up with that reminder that photographs can and should affect us deeply. We can allow that emotional experience. And that matters a lot. If we close ourselves off to the emotional experience, then we've closed our humanity in a way. They're not alone. That we have to immerse ourselves in networks and build relationships and think about histories and stories in order to act in a way that is sustainable. And I heard lots of great thoughts about that are beyond what I'm saying. But I really appreciate you all coming and having these conversations and sharing your time with me. And I hope that you have a lovely evening.